The crime and punishment headlines can get pretty grim, and what we get is generally just the facts. Who got hurt, who did the hurting, what the police did, how the courts ruled. We don't get to know much about what goes on behind bars, and much has been said already about the prevalence of mental illness in lockup, jail, and prison. Our guest this hour pulls stories from all over the country to give us a coherent picture. Alisa Roth is the author of Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. Alisa Roth may be a familiar voice to public radio audiences. She's a former staff reporter for Marketplace and a contributor to other NPR programs. She has also had work published in the New York Times and the New York Review of Books. Alisa Roth, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
You start with what is still many people's idea of how we used to treat mental health patients, and that's Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest on film. Forgot, though, until you brought it up in the book, that why it was that R.P. McMurphy was faking mental illness in the first place.
So, in fact, he had been arrested and was trying to get out of a prison sentence by saying that he was insane and needed to be in the hospital instead. Of course, what he found was that hospital was not much better and possibly worse than what he was avoiding.
So it's interesting to have that context, and it's a great way to start the book because it gets us into thinking about, oh, there was a time when people thought if they could fake mental illness, they would not have to be in lockup. But that is really not the case anymore, is it?
No. Today, about 50% of the people in jail and prison have a mental illness. And a lot of people in the community still think that, you know, oh, people are trying to fake it to get out of it. But in fact, if you have mental illness, you're more likely to end up in jail or prison than not.
Wow. There's a couple of things to understand here. We've talked about the warehousing in huge state hospitals largely being over. How sharp a decline has it been, Alisa?
It's tremendous. There was a point where in the middle of the 20th century when something like 500,000 people were living in some kind of an institution. Today, that number has gone down to under 200,000, even less. So it's a tremendous decline, but it's important to remember that even at the height of institutionalization, so at the time that Ken Kesey was writing, there were large numbers of people with mental illness who were still living in the community and were getting treatment, whatever treatment they were getting in the community. So it's not that we have this idea that most people were living in psychiatric hospitals, and that just wasn't the case.
There are a couple places in your book where people's brains are going to get a little overloaded when they realize things like some of the largest providers of psychiatric care in the country are actually correctional or at least holding facilities.
That's right. The three largest providers of psychiatric care in the United States are the jails in New York City, Chicago, and Los Angeles. But that's because those are the biggest jails. So just about any county that you go to in the United States, you're going to find the largest provider of psychiatric care is, in fact, the county jail.
Wow. So that itself should tell you something here. And then we're talking about potentially up to 50% of the people behind bars needing psych care. Is there any particular difference between jail, where people are sent awaiting trial, and prison, where they're sent upon conviction?
You have higher rates of mental illness in jail because the turnover, so just we tend to use those terms interchangeably, and you have been differentiating correctly that jail is pre-trial, pre-conviction. Once you're convicted, you're sent on to prison. So a lot of people, many more people cycle through jail than actually end up in prison. So you tend to get higher rates of mental illness. People tend to be less stable because often they're coming off the street rather than coming out of jail where they may have gotten some previous treatment.
So you're not the first person to point this out, that we've talked for several years about the prevalence of mental illness all through the criminal justice system and everything from police encounters with people on the street to what happens behind bars once people are sentenced. What has the response been thus far, though, because there has been a fair amount of talk about this?
It's interesting because what I found is that you can talk to people on across the political spectrum and on both sides of, law and order versus we should stop locking people up or stop locking up so many people at any rate. What I found is that people are very much in agreement that what we're doing right now in terms of locking up so many people with mental illness is wrong. So you hear the police say it, you'll hear the prosecutor say it, you'll hear the defense attorney say it, you'll hear the family say it, you'll hear the judges say it. Everybody's still trying to figure out how do we negotiate getting people out of jails and prisons, or how do we keep them out to begin with. But there does seem to be pretty broad agreement that this is not the right way to do it.
All right. But are there any facilities really set up in a position to handle the kind of loads of people they would need to take on if we stop sending people to jail?
Well, part of the question is, do people really need to be institutionalized? So just because somebody doesn't belong in jail doesn't mean that he belongs in a psychiatric hospital long term. It may be that he needs to be in the hospital for a couple of days or a couple of weeks or even a couple of months to get stabilized. But that doesn't mean that that person can't live in the community. So one of the issues that I encountered over and over is that there is really this lack of healthcare available in the communities, and even where that healthcare is available, it's very, very difficult to access. So part of the solution is figuring out how to get people to be able to get treatment for their mental illness before they end up in the criminal justice system, or if they get caught in the system, once they're released, where do they get released to so that they can continue to get that care and not end up back in jail or prison.
That always seems to be the real sticking point, Elisa, from years of watching this be discussed, is that people do fine under close supervision, but without it, if there's not somebody that says, hey, take your meds, you know, keep up with this practice, that practice, things can change drastically and rapidly.
Absolutely. And as with other medical conditions, people are not always very compliant with taking their medication. So they start out taking it like they're supposed to, but when they start to feel better or they're aggravated by the side effects, then they quit. So one of the things that has worked is assisted outpatient treatment, which is outpatient treatment that's designed to mimic the level of care that you have in an institution. So somebody lives in the community but has a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a housing specialist, and so on. But it is tricky. It is very tricky.
Much more to talk about with Elisa Roth. Her book is Insane, subtitled America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. Back on The Exchange with Elisa Roth and you in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking for the second time today about the crossing point of the criminal justice and mental health systems on a national perspective, this time with Elisa Roth, who's telling us about the things she learned in a series of visits in different parts of the country within the criminal justice system about how people are dealt with when they have mental illness within the system, and it could be as many as 50% of the inmates have a mental illness. Elisa Roth's book is called Insane, subtitled America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. You can join the conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. One trend that pops out, particularly after mass shootings, Elisa, is it seems to be more pressure for involuntary commitment, where we say things like, well, you know, if that guy had been locked up, we wouldn't have had to deal with him shooting up the Waffle House or the, you know, whatever place got shot up most recently. Do you see much support, though, for returning to a system where, I mean, involuntary commitment is very hard now in most states, isn't it?
It's extremely difficult, and it's actually something I heard over and over again from parents and other family members, that our push for civil liberties for people with mental illness has gone too far, and it's made it too difficult for people to get help for their loved ones when they've really deteriorated to a point that they need that help. But when we think of involuntary commitment, I mean, talk about, you know, the shooter at the Waffle House, say, I think there's this idea that, you know, somebody's going to be involuntarily committed and locked up in perpetuity. And in fact, in most cases, people are, if you manage to get somebody involuntarily committed, it's for a couple of days, or if they go before a judge, maybe a couple of weeks. But it's not that somebody's going to be put away in a psychiatric hospital for a long time.
Case in point you bring up in the book, Christopher Rodriguez, Christopher with a K in Florida. He and his mother have been through a lot. Can you give us a sketch of their story?
Christopher Rodriguez developed mental illness as a teenager, and initially his mother thought that he was just devastated by the death of his grandmother, with whom he'd been really close. But she came home one day, found he had disconnected the hot water heater, and he said that the CIA was, I think, listening in on their conversations or something through the hot water heater. And so she had him committed involuntarily. He got out. She got him treatment. And this went on for years and years and years. He was finally picked up in a drug case and sent to jail, where he spent several years awaiting trial. And part of the problem was that he was so sick most of that time that he couldn't even go before a judge. He couldn't take a plea. His case just stopped while he'd be hospitalized and brought back. And he was finally sent to the state prison, where he's been for the last almost decade. And most of that time, he has been so sick that he doesn't recognize her. The state often denies her visits to him because the state says he's so sick that he can't have visitors. And she really feels like he's not getting the medical treatment that he needs in the prison in Florida.
Do health records and information about the best approaches to treatment follow inmates through the system? I mean, is there at least that much that goes on?
Most of the time, they do not. And this is a huge problem. So when Christopher Rodriguez was sent, he spent 2 or 3 years in the county jail. During that time, he was twice hospitalized for psychiatric issues, and a third time was hospitalized because he was so psychotic that he hurt his genitals very badly and had to have an operation. So there was a clear record of mental illness in the county jail. He had a record of mental illness before he was ever arrested, which his mother shared with the jail. But when he got into the Florida state system, he spent the first 9 months or a year in the general population, running into trouble on and off, but it took the state that long to realize that he was so sick that he needed to be in a special unit for people with mental illness.
Wow. So just in a general sense, how did you get as much information as you got, Elisa, from two fairly closed systems? I mean, you mentioned in the book the issues with HIPAA, the Privacy and Healthcare Act. So how did you get information from not only criminal justice but also from the medical system?
Well, it's hard because, as you know, in order to get medical records, somebody has to sign a release for it. And so in the case of Christopher Rodriguez, his mother was extremely helpful. She has a power of attorney for his health care and was able to sign over, request the records, and then hand them over to me. But it's a real problem to understand what people's issues are. And this presents a real problem for the jails and prisons. Because if somebody's been treated in the community as, say, Christopher Rodriguez was, and as so many of these people have been, it's, you know, in some cases they show up in jail and have never been treated, but in a lot of cases they've been in and out of the mental health care system in the community, but they show up in jail and the jail providers have a very hard time accessing those records. So the psychiatrist or the psychologist in jail can't go back to the clinic and say what worked, what didn't, or it's very, very difficult for them to do that.
Elisa Roth, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Insane, subtitled America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. Here's a call from Robert and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange. Robert, go ahead.
Yeah, that's Robert Eubank. Thank you. The comment that I had, and it actually encompasses both of your guests today, it's really unfortunate when you don't have more direct access to people that are both experienced with the system itself and experienced with the research involved. The pathology involved is a little bit flawed, and that sort of means not relying on the accounts of parents. Actually, criminal justice isn't actually reliable. There was a study done by the University of Virginia's MacArthur Foundation that did a pretty close correspondence between people that were actually in the state hospital and released and out in the community. The demographics were basically matched up, and that study found that people who were exiting the state hospital, the fraction of 1% of people who were actually committed to a state institution, were actually slightly less violent, absent substance abuse, than the normal population. But yet the wider stigmatizing assumption is that all those people are violent, they have this unpredictable behavior, and they're going to take the rights away. You know, it's pretty hard as an advocate listening to somebody saying, there's too many civil rights advocates saying we can't lock these people up. Or the treatments involved just by themselves are not necessarily the answer. These invasive biological biopharmacological cures have extreme flaws that essentially run into, there was a study also done by the national directors of state mental health programs that showed that people that were in the public mental health system taking the medications and doing stuff died about 25 years earlier, and about 40% of those are deaths as a result of health problems caused by the medications that they're giving people. So if they want to go out and look for people who are dying and causes for that, I mean, they really need to put it back on a scientific basis and take into account the experience of the users of the system, because it's a much different picture from the bottom up than from society's panic-driven processes like the Murphy Bill and other things. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. Appreciate that. So panic-driven processes, is that a fair description, Elisa, of how things have been dealt with over the years with dealing with mental illness in America?
I mean, I think that we do treat mental illness as crisis management. So when somebody is starting to get sick, starting to show symptoms, and in many places they show up in a clinic to get care, they'll be sent away and told to come back when they're more symptomatic, when they're sicker. So this is the sort of the physical equivalent would be sending, you know, somebody comes in very overweight and not exercising, smoking, eating too much, comes in and says they're having chest pains, and the doctor says, well, come back when you've had that heart attack or you've had that stroke or you've developed diabetes. And we wouldn't accept that in the physical realm, but in the mental health care realm, it seems to be the reality in a lot of places. And so then when the person finally deteriorates to the point where it's a crisis, the only option, you call 911, and the response is from the police, not from healthcare workers. So there is a crisis management aspect to all of this.
Elisa Roth, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There's one very important part of the book, well, many important parts of the book, I should say, but one that makes a very clear case for not drawing a straight line from the drawdown of the state hospitals and the warehousing of people to prison. As you point out, there's a bit more that happened in between.
Yes, when we look at, so first of all, there's the question of how many people were actually living in institutions at the time when the institutions were their largest. And the fact is, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of people were in fact living in the community already at that time. When we look more closely at the populations of those hospitals, they were largely white, female, elderly, and had diagnoses for the most part of schizophrenia, or very heavily diagnosed with schizophrenia. When we look at the population of jails and prisons, as we all know, they tend to be young, not white, male. And when you look at the range of diagnoses, it's much closer to what we see in the wider world. So they're disproportionately higher numbers of people with mental illness, but you're seeing a range of bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, major depression, and so on. And I argue that this crisis of mental illness in the criminal justice system is really as much a story of mass incarceration as it is of mental illness. So all the ways that we have driven our incarcerated population up to 2.2, 2.3 million people. So the war on drugs, broken windows, policing, all of those things have helped to catch many more people with mental illness. But it's not this very straightforward, straight line story that we like to tell, that we open the doors of the asylums and 5 years later, all those people ended up in jail or prison.
Right. Very different populations, as you point out. And, you know, it's not like a new struggle in America either. You take us back through the Penrose hypothesis and Dorothea Dix, who did a lot for people with mental illness. Benjamin Franklin weighed in on mental health care. So it sounds like we've been trying for close to 300 years to give people the care they need and still haven't quite found the right place.
We have never known how best to treat people with mental illness. So you talk about Benjamin Franklin. He made a plea to build the first psychiatric unit in a general hospital that was in Philadelphia by saying that people with mental illness are wandering around the countryside terrorizing good citizens. So I think this notion of people with mental illness as being violent and dangerous and threatening is a thread through our history that's helped keep people with mental illness in jail and prison over the centuries. But we've just never quite known, do they belong in a hospital? Should people with mental illness be in a hospital unit or, a psychiatric unit in a regular hospital? Should people live in the community? And if they do, how do we get them the treatment that they need? And more recently, I think that we've been far more willing to spend money on crime prevention or on public safety than we have on the front end, so the prevention side of making sure that people get the care that they need.
Another case study I want to bring in here, Brian Allen Sanderson is mentioned very early in the book, was a firefighter, would have been a hero in many people's eyes, but his life took a really strange turn.
Brian Sanderson was a firefighter in Williamsburg, Virginia, and he had a really regular life. He had a wife. He had a kid. He had started this business on the side, a handyman business. He hired a lot of his former colleagues. And then he developed bipolar disorder. And after a couple of suicide attempts, started getting treatment, then went off the medication. As we talked about, this is something that happens commonly, became very, very psychotic and started hearing voices. And the voices told him that he needed to go to San Antonio, Texas, and open up a homeless shelter. So he got in his car and he started driving. And somewhere in South Carolina, the voice told him he ought to stop, stay in a hotel, which he did. And things sort of deteriorated from there to the point where he ended up in an elevator with no clothes on, riding the elevator up and down. The hotel called the police on him, called the sheriff's department. And he was arrested, and he was charged with indecent exposure, which in South Carolina can get you 3 years in jail. And so he was taken to jail. He was, again, completely out of his mind, thought that the corrections officers were going to kill him, that they wanted to kill his son, ended up in solitary confinement, as is very common. And finally, after 6 months, the judge said, get out of here, go home. He did. He was fine for a while. Again, went off the medication, again became psychotic, became convinced that his neighbor was building bombs in the apartment downstairs. Brian broke into the apartment thinking he was saving the community from this terrorist attack, was picked up. The police actually convinced him to go to the psychiatric hospital for an exam. So this is, in theory, the outcome that we want. But while Brian was sitting in the hospital going through the intake process, he had a delusion that the woman who was asking him the questions was the devil. And he said it was the most terrifying thing in his life, that her face just turned into this demon face with spinning eyes and all sorts of things. And he stood up and punched her. And so he was taken to jail, where the voice told him to blind himself. And he's now blind, living in Virginia, pretty much housebound. So a terrible story of how this can deteriorate very, very quickly from mental illness into this very permanent disability that could have been avoided if the criminal justice system had not been part of it.
That's the thing, though. I mean, when I keep coming back again to the whole idea of, like, well, somebody is out of control. That's the easiest term, I guess, to apply. But then what do you do? I mean, the inclination for a lot of people is, well, lock them up, get them away from us. And so then you've got this situation where you're putting them in a system that where confinement is actually worse for the condition they're in.
Or at least confinement in jail. I mean, he was locked in a cell by himself. The way he describes it, he was on the floor of his cell, kind of coming in and out of these blackouts where he didn't know where he was, he didn't know why he was there. And one can only think that if he had stayed in the hospital where people know how to deal with mental illness and where they could have given him emergency medication to help deal with the psychosis, for example, that maybe the outcome would have been different. What was shocking to me, among many things in that story, was that I read of his hospital records, and he was in the hospital having blinded himself, and the psychiatrist wrote a report that Brian Sanderson doesn't know why he was in jail, but he the psychiatrist, doesn't see why he can't go back there. And at that point, why is he there? What purpose does it serve to send a man who is so psychotic that he doesn't realize he's just blinded himself back to jail for punching somebody? Of course, he shouldn't have punched the tech. On the other hand, can we not see past his illness, or can we not see that this is a direct link to his illness and maybe find another way to deal with it?
Wow, one of many questions that linger as we go through the book, Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness, with the author Elisa Roth, our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. Welcome back, and talk more to Lisa. If you'd like to join us by phone or email, we'll talk to you as well when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Elisa Roth, who was a former staff reporter for Marketplace and had contributed to other NPR programs, also had work published in the New York Times and the New York Review of Books. She has taken on a tall task in looking at the intersection or collision of the criminal justice and mental health systems in America in a book called Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So one of the, you mentioned that the some of the largest providers of psychiatric care are the city lockups in New York City, Chicago, and L.A. L.A. County Jail, as you point out later in the book, though, has an accredited psychiatric ward. Are the results any better for people who end up there than in some of the other institutions?
For the people in L.A. County who end up on that unit, the inpatient unit, the outcomes are better in the sense that they're being treated in what amounts to a psychiatric unit. There are critics who say that jail and prison are simply not a place to treat mental illness, period. You are never going to have a proper behavioral health unit in a jail or prison because the environment is just wrong for it. But if you're comparing that inpatient unit to even the special mental health units in LA County, it's a little bit quieter, it's a little bit calmer, the medical care is a little bit more intensive, and it is much closer to what you would see in a hospital unit, let's say. New York has created similar behavioral health units where they're separate from the rest of the jail. In New York, they've really made it a point to provide very intensive programming. So there's treatment by psychiatrists, but there's also all kinds of one-on-one therapy and group therapy and art therapy and just meaningful activity during the day. There's something for people to do. And I think this is critical. In the New York units, they have made it a point to reward good behavior rather than to punish bad behavior. So in jail or prison, most of the time you break a rule, you're going to get punished, which is particularly hard for people with mental illness. They have trouble following the rules. They have trouble understanding the rules in some cases. And so what they found in New York is that people do much better on these units, even if they're still in this jail environment.
Let's take a call here. We have Gregory and Applegate on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Alisa Roth, the author of Insane.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Gregory.
Okay, I wasn't sure you could hear me. I'm getting out of range. Yeah, I just wanted to say that in 30 years I worked in psychiatric hospitals, minimum, medium, and maximum security prisons with juveniles and adults. I also worked in parole and probation, and I experienced a large number of people in prison who were mentally ill, and there they were denied medical care, and they were frequently victimized, extortion, assaults, rape. They became more victimized and sicker as a result of being sentenced to prison.
All right. Thanks for the perspective on that, Gregory. And I imagine this echoes a lot of what you had picked up along the way, Alisa.
It does. All too often, we take people with mental illness, put them in jail or prison, and when they come out on the other side, they're far sicker than when they went in. And part of the problem is that jails and prisons aren't therapeutic environments, but part of the problem is also what the caller said, that people just aren't getting the treatment that they need. So people in jail and prison are the only group in the United States who have a constitutional right to health care, and that includes mental health care. But the way that's been defined, it really leaves a lot of leeway about how we define adequate care. An additional complicating factor is that unlike physical illness where, you know, somebody has cancer, we can see that tumor, somebody has diabetes and their sugar levels are over whatever that number is, with psychiatric diseases, there is some leeway in the diagnosis. So if a jail or prison is deciding how it defines who is mentally ill, in some cases, people just aren't getting the treatment that they need because they haven't been identified as needing the treatment, even if they actually do need it.
We've talked a bit about the facilities in New York and Los Angeles, and I want to get to Chicago because this is important. There's a process at the Cook County Jail for assessing mental health needs up front. Can you tell us what they do there?
So when you're arrested in Cook County, which is the county surrounding Chicago, you're brought to the Cook County Jail. And before you're even charged with a crime, you go through a mental health screen. It's the first mental health screen you get. And you're asked a series of questions by a mental health professional about your history. So have you been treated for mental illness? What were you diagnosed with? Do you have a substance use disorder? What were you using? What has worked in the past? There are even questions about PTSD. So they always ask how you celebrate the 4th of July, because if you say that you hide under the bed and try to wait out the fireworks, it's a sign that maybe you've been traumatized by, say, gun violence in your neighborhood. And what that means is that if somebody needs medication, the jail healthcare people can start that process of getting the medication they need, of getting the treatment the person needs very, very early in the process. And then there's a second screen after the bond hearing and after you're charged and all that, but it really gets the process going in a way that many jails don't do.
How much value is there in treating mental illness early? I mean, in recognizing early what might be happening and then beginning to take steps at that point rather than waiting for an acuteness of the situation?
There is more and more data showing that early intervention is key to better outcomes. And so there have been a whole host of studies recently with schizophrenia in particular that if you can intervene right after that first episode of psychosis, that the person is much less likely to have further episodes, or if they do have them, they'll be less serious. There's also data showing that repeated untreated episodes of psychosis can actually do permanent damage. And so we have this growing understanding that psychiatric illness is in this way very much like physical illness, that you want to treat it early, you want to treat it aggressively early, because people just do better in the long run.
Well, it is like an infection left untreated or a bone left unset after a break. So it does get worse. So beyond the early treatment, consistency in treatment, I mean, once somebody's been identified correctly with a diagnosis, in lockup, how hard is it for mental health professionals to keep up with them?
It's hard because in most places there aren't enough clinicians to go around, and there's a lot of turnover. So I heard over and over from people that they would see one doctor one time and then they wouldn't see anybody for a couple of months and then they'd see another doctor. And in any medical relationship, of course, you want to have that sense of trust and knowing you want the patient to have a comfort level with the doctor or the clinician, but you also want the clinician to have a sense of that patient to know what's that person's baseline. And you're missing that. In jail, it's also complicated because turnover is high. So somebody could be there for 6 months, but he could also be there for 3 days. And so this consistency becomes very, very difficult.
Let's take another call. Misha in Eugene, thank you for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Elisa Roth, the author of Insane.
Yeah, hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I read a book called Anytime Someone Tries to Say There's Something Wrong with Someone, Don't Believe Them. There is no such thing as mental illness. Peter Bragan is, people may be aware, who's a radical psychiatrist. When he was undergraduate, he was able to help, and his colleague were able to help people get out of institutions by caring about people. And Peter Bragan also doesn't believe in medications. He said that some medications, the family members found out to destroy people's brains. Artie Lang, a radical psychiatrist, he was in New York, and what he did, he saw somebody that was, quote-unquote, supposedly autistic, and the person was rocking, a young adult. He went in there and rocked with her, and she opened up. And Artie Lang also took someone when he was studying to be a psychiatrist. He took someone off to go somewhere, and that guy came back to life. And I think the thing is we have so many people in prison, and what we need to do is think about helping people, not – they used to say in the psychiatrists used to say in the 19th century, if someone has a problem with emotional stuff, they can get better. Now it's like it's a big industry and putting everybody on drugs and medications and maybe hurt people a lot.
All right. Thank you for that, Misha. Appreciate that. So that is part of the picture that you talk about in the book, Elisa. I mean, are there cases where people are getting medication they perhaps should not be getting while they're in lockup?
We have certainly recreated in our jails and prisons many of the conditions that we saw in the state psychiatric hospitals back in the day. And among those is the overuse of medication. So medication can, on the one hand, be expensive. On the other hand, if you have a large population that you need to control, over-medicating can be one way of doing that. And I talk to doctors who describe visiting jails and prisons around the country where you see people who are clearly terribly over-medicated.
I want to ask about one final personal case, Jermichael Mitchell in Virginia. What was he arrested for?
He was arrested for stealing a small amount of candy and soda pop from a 7-Eleven. And he, like many of these people, had a long history of mental illness. I think in his case it was schizophrenia. Was brought to the jail where, according to his family and his attorneys, he wasn't fed, wasn't given his medication, and was in fact taunted and tortured by the corrections officers. And he ended up dying after several weeks in jail from what amounted to starvation.
Wow. So is there a baseline of training for police or corrections officers on handling people going through mental episodes?
Police and corrections officers have become the de facto frontline responders. So in the police case, it's the first responders on the street. For the corrections officers, they're the first line responders in jails and prisons. And in many, many places, they receive little or no training in how to deal with somebody who has a mental illness. And in many cases, the training that they do get really goes counter to everything that you want to do when somebody's in a mental health crisis. So a police officer is trained to come in very quickly and take control of the situation, and really enforce order by being bold and aggressive and strong. And for somebody who is in a mental health crisis, particularly if they have paranoia, somebody who comes in and starts yelling at them to do something, it's terrifying. I mean, it's terrifying for anybody, but it's particularly terrifying for somebody who's struggling with what's real, what's not. More and more places realizing that police and corrections officers are these first responders are providing training to recognize the symptoms, to talk about how do you get a situation under control without being aggressive? How do you protect yourself? Because being a police officer is a dangerous and frightening job. Likewise, a corrections officer, it can be dangerous. You can be a single person or two people watching hundreds of people on a jail or prison floor. So how do you respond and keep yourself safe? How do you keep order in a facility? Because if it deteriorates into sort of a chaotic situation, that can be very dangerous for everybody. So more and more places are providing special training. And from the data that there is, the outcomes are much better when people are properly trained.
So you are starting to see evidence of places where people are trying different approaches, and they do appear to be bearing some fruit.
Many, many police departments have started training people, and we are seeing some mild improvement, yes.
All right, but just the same, we're in a position where a book like this is not the last of its kind, I'm sure, and we continue to hear discussions of the uneasy intersection of the criminal justice and mental health systems in this and other works. This book is called Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. It's the work of Elisa Roth, who used to work for The Marketplace and contributed to other NPR programs, has also had work published in The New York Times and New York Review of Books. Elisa, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take it easy.